There's still time to save big on your landscaping project at Menards. Create stunning patios and strong retaining walls with our huge in-stock selection of concrete blocks ready to take home today. Plus, get free estimates fast with our easy-to-use design and buy program in-store or on Menards.com. Don't miss out. Check out our weekly flyer and start saving on landscape blocks now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacy Cole, and Todd Michaels.
When investigators went into this and in these interrogations, you know, it feels like they're going in, they're trying to crack the nut, essentially. Let's get to what we think we're going to get here. And let me ask you this. When you're going in to interrogate someone, when you're going in to try and find what you want to, you know, not necessarily you want to be the truth, but you're trying to get to the truth. I think that's a big difference there. To the truth or want to get to what you believe is the truth. You have to go in not necessarily knowing what the truth is if you don't truly know what this person is up to. How do you recognize when there's nothing to crack in that nut, when you're sitting there and you're asking questions? Obviously, people can sit there and they're going to be difficult, and it can take a long time in interrogation to get actual, you know, results and actual answers. But at what point do you go and what sort of signs do you look for and say, this isn't our person? And what did they miss here in this with the four guys that they were going after for all of that time? What were they missing here in terms of the signs that they should have looked at and said, these aren't our guys?
It's hard to walk a mile in the shoes of the investigators at the time.
Yeah.
But the first question I asked in all the espionage investigations I always did was, the first question you ask as an investigator is, what would compel this individual that I think might have done it to do it? And then in order to answer that question, you start looking at the behavior arc. You know, so tell me where they grew up. Tell me about the home life. Tell me about the upbringing. Tell me about if they have healthy, happy relationships in their lives or they don't have healthy, happy relationships in their life. The fact that these people were friends, well, that's a shot against them being the ones that did it because it's kind of unusual. So I'm always looking at the behavior arc because if all of a sudden, because we do this all the time, if these four individuals don't have a background and a history of escalating violence, anger, emotional instability, ability to self-regulate their emotions, all these things, if all four aren't escalating towards a moment of doing this type of violence, the likelihood of me going down a track and bringing them in to interrogate them in that way is slim to none. I can't imagine me doing it. But then again, I'm not I wasn't a homicide detective doing it, but I've done this so many times before where I would have these cases referred to me on yet. Cause again, I worked counterintelligence. So I'm the espionage guy. Every time a case got referred to me as a potential for espionage where they betrayed their country. And a lot of times they've done other heinous things. The first question I always asked was from the people around them in their lives. The first thing you do is you interview people, tell me about them. And I'd always ask my opening questions. Tell me about what you think about the individual. Do you like them? And if they said, if they're in tears because, oh my God, he's such a good guy, I can't imagine he'd ever do this. Likelihood of you having your guy goes down drastically. And if I have not just one person, but now multiple people tell me what a good person this is, and that, you know, you just, you know, all these data points are telling me the likelihood of this being the person, probably not there. Because from all these people in your life thinking that you're a good, healthy person, and then you have four people having that same kind of reaction, that arc is not the arc that's going to spike out of, all right, I'm going to go kill four people right now, four girls.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be a history. There's got to be something. And also, and if it's a community like this, you're going to be, because what they should have been doing too, that who knows if they were or weren't, you're looking for connection. Mm-hmm. It is, and I know this is one of the 5% of the cases out there, I think it's 5 or 10%, where there's not some sort of connection to either the yogurt place or the victims between the killer. Very, very rare. And so those are other things I'm looking at. So there's so many data points that should have been brought in and looked at and examined before they brought them into an interrogation room, an interview room, which always starts out as an interview, before you bring them up to the ledge, before you make an accusatory statement. They accused hardcore right in there without any of those, with inconsistencies, all those data points. It just makes sense to me.
isn't there a, I'm trying to think back to when this all kind of began in my brain. Like I ask a question sometimes of people that talk about somebody who is really a good person. It's like, have you looked in their freezer to make sure there's not any severed heads? You know, because it always seems like it's somebody that you see those, you know, reports on the news. Oh, they were always such a wonderful person. I can't imagine that they did this, but yet they did it. So how do you reconcile with what you just talked about? Because obviously you know what you're doing, but doesn't it always seem like it's the one person you would never suspect?
Sometimes gaps. So it's the people that generally say that are the neighbors next door that see you 5%, you know, that you see their 5-second highlight reel. When they come out to go to work in the morning, they come home at night. You might see them for snippets of time on the weekends. So what I'm looking for then is I'm looking for people that are actually close, that spend 90% of their time with them. What are they saying? What's their arc? And also, who are they? Because I also going to take in not just what they're saying about the individual. I want to see what they're saying about themselves as well. So I understand, hey, if you have a lot of unhealthy things going on your life, you're addicted to drugs, you're addicted to alcohol, you got a lot of trauma and you've been abused in your entire life. And you're saying, you know, Joe Schmuckatelli is a great guy. Well, now I can understand what that reference point is compared to you. So I need to understand who I'm interviewing, the depth of field of knowledge they have of the individual, the kind of relationships they typically have in their life, because that's given me this is a thing that you get through life reps, is that every time I'm looking at one individual, I'm trying to understand, in order to understand them, I'm not just talking to everyone around them. I have to understand everyone around them at the same level I'm understanding them, because I'm understanding the entire intricate network of everyone around them to understand them at a more deep level, because I have to give them kind of a reference point on the information I'm getting. Are they, in other words, if someone says someone's a good person, but they're actually unhealthy people themselves, unhealthy looks healthy to the other person. Mm-hmm. So I got to understand that. So, and then it's not simple.
Joe Schmuckatelli is a good guy, by the way.
You like that, Joe Schmuckatelli?
I want to vouch for Joe Schmuckatelli.
Thank you, Robin.
Salt of the earth guy.
Yeah, it generally is.
Obviously, we look back on this now. I mean, we are looking at it back now going, well, these were really bad techniques that were being used. But is there anything out there today that says, can't use those techniques? Are there any rules or standards I know the answer to this, but I don't know that the general public does, to say that you can't do these sort of tactics today, and are they still being used in certain places?
I think they are, again, because I've seen this used, and it can be effective if you actually know you have the guy that did it. But you don't. So the thing is, it's a very crude, crass way to go about it, because you're pitting yourself against the individual. I mean, in all situations, what you're trying to do is you're trying to become someone that this individual can rely upon to be your confessor. Mm-hmm. Really, because that's what it comes down to. So think about this.
But would you, I don't mean to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
Would you use this tactic on someone, or these tactics on someone, if you don't know that they are the killer? If you just, you don't have that piece of information, you're still trying to get to it.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Definitely not. So that's a much, much simpler question that I probably can answer. No, you definitely wouldn't, because it serves no purpose. I mean, so here's the thing too. So say you think these people either did it or might be connected to someone who did it, because now you're doing that unhealthy profiling of people that they were doing back then to do this. The last thing you want to do is make an enemy or an adversary from the person that might be connected to the person that did it.
Yeah.
Because if now you make an ally and this person actually isn't the person that did it, wouldn't it be better than to leave them feeling better for having met you? So when they go back to their group, say, you know what? I didn't do it, but I kind of got an inkling who did do it. If you're going to maybe do something to get over this or do something, this cop is a good guy. Go talk to this cop. So what law enforcement always wants to do is also not just be the person that finds you, but also be the person you want to go to. Because again, you want to be the confessor, you know, to Stacy's point earlier. You know, with my own kids, I wanted to be the person they felt safe to talk to.
Yeah.
you know, even when something went sideways, because when someone feels safe to share with you, the only way they're going to share with you is if they know they can share. You're not going to necessarily agree with them, but you're going to help them work that problem together because it was a moment of stupidity. And hey, people do stupid things. Let's do this together so we can move you through the stupid thing. Because if we don't do it together, it's only going to get worse from here. Mm-hmm. And so this is where they also failed because they didn't know they did it. And they're made in an adversarial relationship. They got a false confession from four different people. I mean, just what a recipe for stupid. I understand it, but it makes no sense.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you have to walk back too. I mean, if you're, you know, you're still an active, you know, law enforcement member, and then, well, it turns out that your tactics there led to a false confession that you know, that's some pride that you have to kind of walk back to and go, well, maybe that didn't work out so well. And people aren't always the greatest at changing their ways of doing things or their tactics. But then that's where training comes in. And I think that's the shocking part of a lot of this. The reality is a lot of law enforcement doesn't have a lot of training, especially when you get to smaller departments and even larger departments too. I mean, you know, can we speak to that? I mean, why don't we? I mean, the training, obviously, in different sorts of law enforcement varies dramatically from the FBI to a local law enforcement. I mean, educate us on that a little bit, just how different it is and who we're relying on in a lot of these local jurisdictions to get to the bottom of the truth. And how many more tools do a lot of these people even have beyond just the average citizen?
So the first question that really needs to be answered on this one, and we've seen it, I mean, talking about the last 5-10 years of policing, the training costs money.
Yeah.
That's the easiest answer right there. It's training costs money. And so no money, no training. That's the number one challenge and problem to overcome. The next one is who trained you? Because training doesn't, I mean, I'm an avid reader of a lot of things.
Yes.
I have stacks and stacks of books that give me all the education I need, but education without practice doesn't go anywhere. You need the practice to give you the wisdom, and wisdom comes from reps, and reps should be accumulated when you have the education through the training, which gives you the baseline of where to start. But in order to make it yours, in order to be able to do these things, you need to partner with someone who is a senior teacher, mentor, and guide who has the reps, who can take that art form and take that paint by number that you just learned, and they can teach you how to make art that fits you. So the second problem is not just the funding for the training, but the lack of experience of any teachers, mentors, and guides that have the life reps of having done these things who can sit with you and say, hey, why don't we take a break? Why don't we slow down? And you pull Robin, hey, come with me for a second. Hey, when you're doing this in there, wasn't going anywhere, was it? And why was that? Well, you might not have done it. I mean, did you think about this? Did you do this? Did you do this? So let's go back in. Let's recalibrate ourselves. Let's re-engage. Mm-hmm. And think about how we can inspire this person to want to share information with you rather than trying to convince them to do something that they don't think is in their best interest. Mm-hmm. That's what a teacher, mentor, and guide does. But if you don't have that, your force doesn't have that because people are quitting, they're retiring, they're getting out because it's such an adverse environment, whatever the reasons are, you get situations like this where their only experience getting confessions was using this methodology. Perhaps they guessed right that they actually had someone that actually had committed the crime. They use the same methods and techniques to get this person confessed. And now they think, I'm God. This is the method that works. I'm going to use it this way again. Mm-hmm. And no one's there to refute them because no one else has that experience.
And then you get what you get.
You get what you get.
Yeah.
It is an art form.
It is. And with this being, you know, I guess it's baffling to the general public, to civilians on some of this, because I think sometimes we have these ideas in our mind, oh, this is how it works. This is what's going on behind the curtain. And it's safer and it's easier for us to sit there and go, oh, of course, they're really doing this behind the scenes. They got their stuff together. And it's even more disturbing when it turns out, no, they don't.
Tony, here's the greatest analogy everyone can identify with. Tony, how long have you been doing interviewing?
A long time, decades.
Were you ever taught how to do a radio show and interview someone?
By watching. I don't think I mean like sat down and somebody said, here's how you interview someone.
Yeah, nobody did that.
No, No.
And so you didn't have training.
No. Nope.
You have reps. And so it shouldn't be a shock to anyone that, hey, it's the same thing in law enforcement. You don't
sure.
go, I remember when I went through the FBI Academy, it's like at the time, I think it's 6 or 9 months long. And you go through blocks of instruction for how to conduct an investigation, how to do an interview. We had our interviewing blocks. We had our firearms blocks. And I remember when you get to the field and you're going to start being an FBI agent and you're going to go out on your first interview. And I was 29 years old. And do you really think I learned something in the course of a couple months of training and probably about 8 hours, 8 or 16 hours of instruction in a classroom about how to interview someone, and I'm going to go from 0 to 100 to be the world's best interviewer? Or am I going to rely upon my 29 years of experience of being a human being first?
Mm-hmm.
What happens is we get training to give labels and meanings to behaviors we're already doing in our lives so we can recognize them as being effective or ineffective. So we know what to enhance, and we know what to suppress, and we know what to add to ourselves. And so what we get through training is the ability to self-learn, self-master, because that gives us that baseline. And so if we don't have that in a couple months, in your experience, and most of our experience in life, is we find a passion for what we do and we get life reps in here so we can actually become very fluid. It becomes very natural part of who we are. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've said this to you numerous times, both on air and off, that I think you're one of the greatest interviewers because you are so fluid. I have no idea how you do it because you have so many life reps and years and decades of doing just this. You flow with it. You move with it. When I do these news hits, whether it's on Fox or News Nation or anywhere else, it's so easy for me to see who's got reps. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't have reps by how they're interviewing me, because, and it doesn't because they went to a great school and they went to a better school about how to interview someone. It's because they actually have the life reps. And most importantly, the ones that have the greatest humility to realize that they're constant students and always learning and getting better, those are the ones that are great at this. But if you start thinking that I got this, mm-hmm. like this guy, this cop, I'm not saying what he did or didn't do.
Sure.
If he thinks, and I heard in one interview, he was labeled as a guy who could get a confession from anyone.
It's not a good, it's probably not a good no. rep, to, not a good no, reputation to have.
If you fall in love with your own legend, you're yeah. screwed.
Yeah. If you're the one that's getting confessions from everybody, not everybody has a confession to give.
Correct. Right.
And so that's how this works. And that's why I think we sometimes fall short on our expectations of law enforcement, because you think that there's some magic bullet that you're not getting. No, mm-hmm. here's a magic bullet. They have an opportunity to interview a lot of people, more than the average citizen does. That's where they get their life reps. And that's, you know, the life arc. I mean, think about this. Investigative reporters are another great one. I remember there was a person that wanted to come on my behavior team. They're an FBI agent. They'd been in the FBI only a couple of years. And typically, you only had people on my behavior team. You need at least 5 to 10 years of experience first of being an agent. Mm-hmm. Even entertain bringing on a team. I'm interviewing this person to come on the team. And I said, so what'd you do before you came in the bureau? And they said, oh, I was an investigative reporter. I said, really? How many interviews did you actually do before you came in the bureau? And he goes, oh, I don't know. Let's see. I was an investigative reporter for 5 years. I interviewed 365 days a year because that was a job. You interviewed or you died. And I did typically 3 to 5 interviews a day. And I'm like saying, you're in. Think about that.
Yeah.
3 to 5 interviews a day, 365 days a year for 5 years. That's reps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're on.
No. I didn't realize there would be a math test during this, Rob.
And
I just wanted to.
And you know who that person was? Joe Schmuckatelli.
Yeah. Joe Schmuckatelli. Absolutely.
Joe Schmuckatelli.
I want to know if he exists.
Why is it? I mean, does it just come down to money? I mean, again, we have so many problems in our country where it's like, and it's not funded, and that's why we do things the way we do, and they're not the most effective. Is this just another one of them? I mean, there's other countries that look at the way that we do interrogations and interviews and are horrified. Like their police forces are like, that's not how you get to the truth. Why do we never change anything? Why don't we have standards across the board of here's how we're going to do it? Is the answer simply cash?
Sometimes. That's why I say sometimes.
Yeah.
Also organizations, some organizations value training, some don't. And so the organizations that don't value training typically have a problem with ego.
Yeah.
Because in order to say I need training, you have to say I don't have all the answers. I'm not perfect. I'm flawed. I can continue to learn more.
Which every organization should say that.
Ah, that word should.
Should, yes. Everything should always be like, let's get better. Nobody should be like, we're perfect. That if everything had that attitude. Yeah. I mean, but you're asking an organization to have the... Organizations can't have an attitude. It's the people within the organization that have the attitude.
Cultures.
Exactly. Yep. I was going to say that, yep. We've been in some cultures where they think they're perfect. Yeah. And you just look around and go, oh my God, you are the most flawed I've ever seen.
I think it was Simon Sinek, and he wrote it in Leaders Eat Last, which is based on Marine Corps motto. I think it was his book that said, you know, the greatest organizations are the ones that invest in failure.
Yeah.
In other words, you make it part of your calculation that you're going to learn, and learning is painful sometimes. And that because I know he did say this, you know, organizations and institutions that have a zero defect mentality will fail.
Yep.
Because if you live by fear, you're never going to innovate. You're never going to get better because you're chasing numbers and stats to substantiate your existence to a bean counter that's only looking at beans and not actually the substance of what you're doing. And so because that's a way to try to say, hey, I'm an artist, when all you're doing is painting by number. I keep using that reference, but this is an art form. But you can be taught how to become an artist. Mm-hmm. In order to do that, you need to be mentored under a master. And a master is someone that doesn't have the end state. The master is someone who learns and then knows, I am a constant student. As I've said before, matter of fact, you know, my son's texting me now because he just finished a flight. And I just got to read you, you know, here's the language of a true student.
Does your son know you're reading text live on the air?
From-
no, but, you know, all he said was, you know, holy crap, did they know how to break shit? You know, something to, because he's in flying in a simulator today. And so he's today, the philosophy of what he does is learning has occurred.
That's beautiful.
We're going to constantly shit on you because learning, that's the only way you're going to learn. Matt, he said to me this morning, he goes, you know, he said, the problem with all this learning is that I don't know how to land a plane normally from a simulator. All I know how to do, all I know how to do is learn, land it when it's on fire and no landing gear.
I'll take that.
Yeah, right.
You know, the landing gear's failed. The system's been blown up. You know, the battery's failing and the wings are on fire. That's the only time I know how to land a plane.
Love it. But that's how people learn. And that's what you just talked about. People learn when they make mistakes, as long as you're, you know, gently and kindly escorted through the problem and you figure it out and you do better next time.
It reminds me, again, the book I'm reading right now, I'm sorry, Tony, I'm reading, you get a kick, I'm reading Bruce Lee's, actually by Shannon Lee, Bruce Lee's book, Be Water, My Friend.
Yes. Yeah. You're not going to beat the answer out of somebody. You're not going to get the solution by that.
You'll get an answer. It won't be a right one. It won't be a truthful one. It won't be one full of veracity. Yeah. It'll be a compelled one, and compelled answers are never one. So I always look at it this. I always worked with confidential human sources and people that volunteered to wanted to cooperate with me, because I always said I'd rather work with 5 to 7 confidential human sources give me 120% of their effort willingly than 100 sources give me 5% of their effort reluctantly. Because then I got to verify every single thing comes out of their mouth, which causes more work than if I inspire someone to want to share with me rather than convincing someone. And so the same thing when you're doing an interview, trying to inspire confession, do it in such a way that you don't have to spend another 5 weeks verifying all the inconsistencies with what they said, with what you know is a fact on the ground, and even more so, not just with the facts and data that you know is the case because you didn't give leading questions because you knew the answers. Now you have to verify it against the 3 other people that confessed, which are all over the place. I mean, just I don't know how a prosecutor took any of this. It just makes no sense. Well, it does because of the time, the situation, pressure, and all these things, but.
It was a mess that didn't need to happen. And hindsight is 20/20. But the good thing is, at the end of the day, those families can have whatever version of closure you can call it when your daughters are murdered and you find out who it is. I don't know if that's closure, but it's an answer. And those surviving of the 3 of the 4 that are still alive, their names can be strongly removed from, well, maybe you did do it. There will still always be horrible people out there that are not up on what's going on and still want to blame. But at the end of the day, I think this is about as close as justice as we're going to get in this case for the killer who is dead from 1999. It's a horrible case. Yogurt shop murders. There we go. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. As always, thank you for coming on and giving us your insight in all this.
That's a good one, guys. Great chat. As always. Thank you.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.